It was a devastating moment because we really needed the capital to invest and grow the business. And I knew I had a competitor coming up alongside me. We were perilously short of cash. And so it was very distressing. But it taught me an amazing lesson. When you've got a red flag that someone's flying up in front of you, never ignore it. If someone's showing you who they are, believe them. If they're showing you before you're in business with them that they are not someone you want to do business with, definitely do not.
Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. What we do on this show is we find the world's leading entrepreneurs and CEOs, and we spend about a half hour with them and really dig into their story. We want to understand the strategies and the tips and the tools that they use to make big happen in their business. And by the end of each episode, you'll have actionable ideas that you can implement on your path to big success. To learn more about CEO Coaching International and how we can help you dramatically grow your business, visit us at CEOcoachingInternational.com. How do you shift from devastation to determination when a natural disaster nearly wipes out your business and everything you've worked for? Hi, everybody. Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. I'm your host, Steve Sandusky. My guest today is Sarah Dusick. Sarah is the founder of Under Canvas, which is the leading upscale outdoor hospitality brand that she grew to a value of over $100 million. Today, she is a venture capitalist, a co-founder of a new hospitality company, and the author of the new book, Thinking Bigger, a pitch deck formula for women who want to change the world. In today's show, we explore her incredible journey of taking a business from the brink of collapse to becoming a $100 million powerhouse. In our conversation, Sarah describes the turning point when a devastating storm almost wiped out her business and how she bounced back from that. She also talks about the mindset shift that took her from running a small lifestyle business to scaling a national brand. And then she wraps up with some key lessons on what it takes to make a business investable and scalable. With that, please enjoy my conversation with Sarah Dusick. Take me back to 2012. You have 35 tents set up near Yellowstone National Park. You have a nine-month-old and a three-year-old. You're living in a camper on the property. And then Mother Nature decides to make herself known. So tell me about that turning point in your business and in your life.
Yeah, this was our first season operating an under canvas camp. And we had a product that was not polished yet. And what happened was one fateful afternoon, as often happened late summer, we had a huge thunderstorm come through. And I could see it. I could see it when the black clouds are coming towards you and you can see this, it's coming. And the rain started and then the wind started. And because we could see it, we had evacuated everyone from their tents and asked them to go to our nearby restaurant, which was in our lodge, for cover or to get in their cars. And I had got in our camper with my two children to wait it out. But this storm seemed to go on forever. And I could feel the camper like swaying backwards and forwards. And at one point I thought, I don't even know if this camper is going to stay upright. I don't even know if it's going to get toppled over on its side. And it was horrific. It lasted probably about half an hour, 45 minutes before it passed through. And when the storm ended, I opened my camper door and I looked out at Under Canvas and I looked out at all the tents, and the camp was flattened. It literally looked like a hurricane had been through. It wasn't that severe, but it was a very bad storm and had flattened the camp. And I remember thinking to myself, we're done. This is it. The business literally has been wiped out in a moment. And this is pretty darn bad. I'm not sure there is any coming back from this moment. And I burst into tears. And I was exhausted and I was tired. And I could see our dreams literally had been leveled in front of us. So it wasn't a good day.
Tell me a little bit about exactly what the business is and why that was so devastating for you.
Yeah. So our business model was recreating the safari experience outside of national park destinations in the US. So we basically created fairly large-scale tented resorts. So all of our guests, rather than staying in cabins or hotel rooms, were in a fancy tent. And the tents had beds and bathrooms and furnishings and posh linens and all the rest of it. So we had a beautiful setup. But of course, especially in those early days before we perfected the product, was very susceptible to the weather. And as I looked out at that camp, I just remember thinking, no one is ever going to pay me ever again to sleep the night in a tent, because we hadn't figured out how to really insulate that product from the weather. And it was heartbreaking.
So how did you get past that?
The only way I survived that moment was a member of staff said to me, as I'm crying and calling my husband on the phone and saying, it's finished, it's all over, it's really bad. One of my employees, one of my maintenance guys, said to me, it's really not that bad. I think we can come back from this. Let's get to work. Stop crying. He didn't say it quite like this. He was a bit nicer to me. But basically, he was saying, get over yourself. Stop whining. Stop crying. Let's go fix it. Like, we got to fix it. I was in, this is catastrophic. He was in, it's not that bad. Let's just get to work. Yes, we've got stuff to fix. Let's go fix it. And he really slapped me out of my own sort of distress and my own kind of sense of we failed, it's all so terrible, and really made me get back up and put that camp back together. And by about 11 o'clock that night, we had everybody back in their beds with clean, dry linen. We had every tent re-erected, and the camp looked like the storm had never been. And it was an amazing moment. I did not give one refund that night, not one guest departed. And guests started to help us put the camp back together. We were a small, lean team at the time, and certainly that didn't need to happen. But the guests rallied. It was like this moment of, this is an adventure. And of course, it was not an adventure I wanted to give my guests, but there was a moment of grace available in that moment of disaster. And our guests leaned in, and I leaned in after my pity party, pulled myself together. And we got that camp put back together and put back right, which was an extraordinary moment for me, because it really made me realize, A, we can't do this alone. Anytime we try and build and scale and grow a business, we're going to hit a wall, whether that's metaphorically or physically. And sometimes we need other people to help us get back up. Often coaches are really great for that. When you've hit your moment of, oh, everything's terrible, and then you get back on with your coach and they give you a little slap and they say, come on, let's get back up. Let's get back in the race. You can't give up yet. An employee did that for me at that moment. But it really taught me we can't allow ourselves to be floored by the difficult stuff that comes along in business. And whether that's a physical storm or a metaphorical storm, we are constantly facing battles and challenges in business. That's just being in business. And the real issue is how you handle it. It's not whether it will come. It's like, when it comes, how are you going to navigate it? And are you going to have the capacity and the strength to get yourself back up?
It sounds like what you went through that night was like a dark night of the soul for business. And you obviously came out the other side. So you had the 35 tents, you had the one location, but then there was some point where you decided that, hey, we want to scale this thing. And I think you had to go through several iterations before you finally landed on a model that would enable you to scale. So walk me through the thinking and how you had a bit of a metamorphosis in terms of going from a business that maybe would have $1 million in revenue to a business that ultimately was valued at over $100 million. Tell me about the mindset shift, the thinking, the change that had to take place in you to go from $1 million level thinking business to $100 million plus thinking business.
That was the surprising thing about the end of that summer. We worked our socks off that summer to pull that camp off and keep it functional. But what I realized at the end of that summer was we had a product that people were loving. Like, even throwing a massive storm into the middle of it, people were still loving what we had. And I realized I had something that could be bigger than a small business that was revolving just around me. I suddenly realized I've got a model here that we could scale and we could replicate what we're doing in West Yellowstone and we could do it outside of national parks across the country. Yes, we're going to have to improve the product. Yes, we're going to have to make it stand up to 100 mile an hour winds. Yes, we're going to have to figure a whole bunch of things out we don't know how to do right now. But I could suddenly see there was a possibility for repeating and replicating what we had already done. And that for me is the foundation of scale. Have you got something that you can repeat? Have you got something that you can replicate and do over and over again? And yes, improve the product. And yes, take what you've got and perfect it over time. But have you got something that potentially could scale? And that summer, for the first time, I thought we have a business model that we could scale. And we had been in business, you alluded to it, we've been in business for 3 years already. I started my business in 2009. And this business model was our third iteration. So we'd had a very small camp on the plains in Montana before this. We'd had a tented event business prior to setting up in Yellowstone, and then finally landed on our tented hotel model, which became the business model that we scaled across the US. But it took each time we tried a different new business model, it didn't work as well as we thought it could. It didn't seem to have the demand. It was difficult to sell. It was difficult to get people to come and use our services, whatever they were. Even if we could do hundreds of thousands and maybe even $1 million of revenue, it still felt like there was a ceiling. For the first time with this business model, it felt like there is so much blue sky here. There is a way that we are operating right now, albeit not very well, but there's a version of what we're doing now that we can perfect, that we can replicate, and that we could scale. And that was a massive light bulb moment. And I said to the same employee at the end of the summer who had helped me get back up after that massive storm, he asked me at the end of the summer, "Are you going to do this again? As in, will we open the tented camp again next summer?" And I said, "Yeah, I think we will. And I think we'll do more of them." And he looked at me, and at this point, he's thinking I'm crazy. Because he knows how bad the summer has been, how difficult the summer has been. And he was like, "Why? Why would you do that?" And I was like, "Because I think we're onto something." And when you think you're onto something, you've got to go for it.
There's a lot of people who don't want to have a corporate job, who want to be self-employed, who want to create something that generates a significant income, could be hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in personal income. And they stop there and say, "I got a pretty good life. I'm making a good income." Then there's other people like you who say, "Hey, I want to iterate. I want to figure out a business model that's scalable." Ultimately, you ended up getting some outside investors. What would you say to someone who is self-employed that isn't thinking bigger, that perhaps has everything necessary to really build something, to have something that could have tremendous impact? What would you say to that person? You having gone through, I think, that whole range from being self-employed, nice income, to now building a very large business.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things I say to that. I see women falling into this camp a lot. If I'm generalizing, we see women who've got fantastic small businesses who often are creating a, good lifestyle for themselves. They're able to pay themselves a great salary and they've got a great small business. But they've effectively undersold themselves. There was so much more potential than they actually realized. And I think many of us, female or not, often live with glass ceilings that we feel like we're bumping up against a ceiling because it's maybe this is what I've known. This is maybe the world that I've come from, or that I've got role models for, or that I can manage. Often we get stuck with thinking this is what I'm capable of. And we don't ask a different question and say, what could my business be capable of if I had the right people, the right resources, the right team around me to really go get something done? And I realized for me that I wanted to be someone of influence. I wanted to use the platform I built for building a big company to drive change, to create impact, to have a voice on issues and matters that I cared about. And so for me, I would have been selling myself short if I'd have allowed myself just to stick with building a small business that maybe even I did $1 million a year doing, but that didn't have any long-lasting impact or outreach that would have made a difference. And I think business is an extraordinary tool for driving change. It's an extraordinary tool for creating culture. If you think about our lives today, everything we do, everything we touch has been built by somebody. Like you and I are talking on a call this afternoon, facilitated by a particular company that's making video conferencing possible. And that changes the way you and I can do business. I've had a cup of tea this afternoon that was produced by a tea producer. I'm sitting on a cushion that was made by a company to prevent backache from sitting in a chair for hours and hours a day. So the world that we, you and I live in is created by the companies that we build. And I think that's enormous power to contribute towards building a better world, a world that we want to live in, and driving the changes that we might want to see in the world. So I definitely, bigger is not always better. I'd definitely be the first to admit that. But I do think very often we don't think big because we've placed ourselves under a ceiling for a variety of reasons when we haven't realized the good that we could do and the impact that we could have and the change that we could drive if we just thought a little bit bigger.
Now, there's a big difference between going from a lifestyle business to building, let's call it an enterprise business that's investable, that can survive and thrive long after the founder departs the scene. As you made that transition, what were some of the biggest challenges, hurdles, new learnings that you had to learn in order for you to make that shift from lifestyle to an ongoing, viable enterprise type business?
Yeah, there were so many because I had not come from a business background. I did not have an MBA. I didn't have any exposure growing up to what running a business looked like. So I was figuring everything out as I went along and making a lot of mistakes. But I think one of the biggest transitions that happened for me came from a guest. A guest from New York came and stayed at one of my camps, probably 3 or 4 years into having started to build more locations. And she called me up post stay and said, "You really should raise money for what you're doing. What you have has the potential to be very investable and has the potential to be very scalable. And you could put some fuel in your tank by putting some investment into your business to help you grow faster." And I was like, I didn't know why I would do that. I was like, we're plowing our profits in, we're growing the business as fast as we can. But I realized subsequently, we couldn't grow fast enough just plowing our profits back into our business, which is what we were doing. We had a profitable business, putting everything we had back into it. And I didn't realize the potential that exists. And she said, "Let me teach you and let me show you what a difference building an investable business would make to the value that you could create from building your business." And I remember at the time, I was very naive, but at the time, just like we were describing before, I thought the value of my business was the paycheck that I could get out of it. I could make myself a couple of $100,000 a year and we'd call it good. I didn't realize at that moment that businesses could be valuable in themselves. And that actually I could build something of value, like create an asset that actually had value, and that that could be extraordinarily powerful. And that was a real game changer for me. It was a real switch. And someone even just saying to me, "Hey, you could. You have the potential, you have the capabilities, and you have the onus of what something that could be very investable," was very, not only very affirming for me, but it also really shifted my own sense of self, my own sense of what I was capable of, and my own sense of maybe I should. And of course, there have not been inordinate amounts of women that have built very valuable, very high profile companies. We're still definitely in a small number. But I do increasingly think it's really important that more women do build big, high profile, big, valuable companies, because that's how we get to have more influence on the world. That's how we get to drive the change that maybe we want to see. And that's how we help other women also do it too. If because you it's very difficult to be what you can't see, right? It's very difficult to show up in the world in a way that you're not seeing people who look like you, sound like you show up in the world. And so she helped me start to see my business in a completely different light and started to teach me some of the fundamentals about what being investable looked like. What were the building blocks, not just the building blocks of scale, but the building blocks of how you create value in a company, what that looks and how to manage your business differently, and maybe how to fuel your business differently to think about building a different kind of business.
Let's talk about some of those building blocks. So, what makes a business investable? What makes a business scalable? And what changes did you have to make in your business in order to ultimately get outside investors?
I think fundamentally, I started to learn the metrics that mattered, and that every business, regardless of what industry you're in, regardless of what you do, how your business makes money, there are fundamentals that investors are looking to see. At this moment, I had no idea what those were. EBITDA, multiples, revenue growth, how fast you're growing, what your profit margins are, what your recurring revenue is, what it costs you to acquire customers. There were so many metrics that I just didn't understand. But actually, having some insight into my metrics helped me think about, oh, how I invest and how I build the business differently. Because suddenly I could see like my own business data in a different way that really helped me make decisions in a different way. How I thought about spending, how I thought about my operating costs, how I thought about investing in the business and where we spent capital and where we didn't spend capital. So there were so many things as I started to learn about this is what investors care about that actually was very valuable, not just for trying to get investment, but for realizing, oh, these are the building, these kinds of things help me work on my business, not just in my business. And I was very much used to working in the business day to day, slogging it out, making things happen. But that shift really helped me stand back and look at the business in a very different way.
And in your particular business, were there like one or two or three metrics where you said, look, these are the things that we need to really optimize. These are the things that if we keep doing these, we know the business is going to grow. We know it's going to grow profitably. Were there any things like that in your business?
Yeah, my first big revelation was really about EBITDA and EBITDA is effectively your net income, a fancy accounting term for your net income. But I hadn't realized that how your EBITDA trends over time ultimately affects the value of your business, and that the bottom line number of your business is more critical than any number in the business. You can have all the revenue in the world, but if you don't have a bottom line number, there's a problem. So, learning to optimize and understand what was going to happen to my EBITDA year over year helped me think differently about how I budgeted, how I invested in the business, how much revenue I needed to growth I needed to drive if we were going to try and increase our EBITDA number year over year. So that became the metric that I really razored focused in on. And I thought about how was I going to improve that number year over year. And that became every time we were setting budgets or thinking about growth, I'd be looking at what can I do to that number? What's going to affect that number? What's going to drive it? What's going to change it? How am I going to make it better?
So EBITDA is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And you may have heard of this before, but there's this thing called the Rule of 40, which is something that I had first heard coming out of Silicon Valley. And in many cases, it's applied to SaaS businesses, software as a service business. And the idea is if you take your revenue growth rate and your profit margin, if you add those two together, it should add up to at least 40. What's interesting about that is when you talk about growth and trying to grow EBITDA, so if your revenue is growing 30%, you could get by with a 10% profit margin. 30 plus 10 is 40. If your revenue is only growing 10%, then your profit margin should be 30%. 30 plus 10 is 40. And the idea is that the faster you're growing, the more you're going to be reinvesting back in the business and the lower your profit margins are. So if you're growing fast, an outside investor is going to say, okay, I can deal with the lower profit margin because I know you're growing. On the other hand, if you are not growing, you better have a really high profit margin because you're probably milking the business right now. So what are your thoughts on that? And how did you think about the tension between we want to show top line revenue growth, but we also got to have some level of profit margin here to show that we can grow profitably. How did you think about that tension there?
Yeah. One of the flaws of Silicon Valley, I think, and investment in general, has been that often investors have optimized for growth at the expense of profit. And we've allowed businesses with no clear path to profitability or no sense of how they're ever going to generate revenue to grow very rapidly. But at some point that catches up with you, right? So for me, it was really important to have a profitable model, i.e. generate revenue, be able to operate for a certain amount of cost, and always be able to have profit at the end. Now, you're right. I took all my profits for years and years and years, and I doubled down and I put them back in the business. So I reinvested them. And so I was negative EBITDA for a long time, because effectively I'm taking what I've got and I'm putting it back in the business and I'm expending it. So my EBITDA numbers for a long time were relatively low, but I could show, in some ways, this is simple when you think about like unit growth or store growth, or even in a SaaS model, it works the same way. But can you show sort of unit growth? So like I had, my units were hotels, if you like, I had tented camps, and I could show that in each unit, I could be profitable. I could have a good margin and I could operate it. But when I rolled the company up and I took all my units, all my hotels, my overall number might not be profitable. But effectively, if I can show, hey, my revenue is growing, and I can show that individually, the differentiators of some of my parts might be profitable in their own right, even if I'm rolling it all back up and my corporate overhead expenses are higher and I'm having to invest in team and people and all the rest of it to grow this whole business, I'm still looking good. And that was a really interesting phenomenon for me, which became a sense of thinking about how do I think about revenue growth? How do I think about my margins? And we consistently realized we need to operate each location at this kind of margin for this business. So being profitable at a location level was very important to me in thinking about how do we prove out a business model that fundamentally works piece by piece.
And I think that's interesting, perhaps, to also think about the life cycle or the life stage that a business is in. And I think about Amazon. Amazon's like similar to what you did, in the sense that for years, Amazon was losing money. And a lot of people were wondering, how is this company worth so much money when they're losing money? But I think Amazon understood that we're losing money because we're growing fast, we're reinvesting in all these distribution centers. And if we decided at any point in time to just turn the spigot off and stop here, we would be profitable overnight,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
And so investors could see that, and they understood that the underlying business model was or could be profitable. But the fact that the stage that they were in, which is there's a huge opportunity here, we're going to reinvest. Is that sort of similar to how you were thinking about your model?
100% the same. Yeah, exactly. We had the same philosophy that if we had to stop growing overnight, we could be profitable. Like bottom line would be good if we'd stopped plowing everything back into growth. Yeah, but that we just felt like speed, when you've got an opportunity and there is a market that you can capture, speed is definitely important. I felt like I have a moment here. I have a moment to lead a market. I have a moment to pioneer something that's not been done before and to be the market leader in my space. And that means I'm going to have competition nipping at my heels. So that was one of the things that spurred me to think about getting investment, because I realized I'm going to get eaten up alive by my competitors if I can't keep growing and outperforming everybody else? And thinking about if I can't keep up, if I can't keep reinvesting at the rate that other people could, if they were coming along, I could lose my whole business. So it was a risk not to grow rather than to try and play it safe. I could be completely missing out, not just on the growth potential, but I could get swallowed up by a competitor if I can't compete with them or be better than them. And that was a real interesting turning point for me with thinking about the speed at which we grow at and the importance of leading in this in a particular arena.
So you mentioned that you plowed all your profits back into the business. Now, eventually you took some outside capital, and your new book, Thinking Bigger, is all about creating that pitch deck to be able to get people to invest in the business. So walk me through your decision to decide we want to get some outside capital, and then walk me through any misfires that you may have had in that whole process of trying to raise capital, and what was the ultimate realization that you came to that enabled you to get some outside investment?
The thing that really pushed me over the edge to decide, okay, we should go raise capital, was that there was a competitor came into my space, and he was in New York and had an idea for a business that looked exactly like mine. And he was pitching this idea to venture capitalists in New York and elsewhere. And I had heard there was a guy raising capital for a business that looks exactly like your business. And I suddenly realized, and he went on to raise, I think at that point, about $15 million, which was way more money than we had been able to put into our business.
So he didn't have any tented sites or anything. He just had an idea here.
An
Okay.
idea.
He had your idea.
He had my idea that I was already executing, and I had three camps by this point, and each camp was profitable in its own right. So we had a profitable business model, we had high demand, and had figured out we've got something we can definitely scale and replicate because we're already doing it. And I'm hearing, oh, someone else is taking my idea, getting millions of dollars of backing, and if I'm not careful, he could wipe us out because he'll be able to outspend me. The race was on for the best sites, the best market opportunities. And if he came and set up alongside me in the places where I was and had more money to build a better camp or undercut my prices, I felt like we would be at risk. And potentially we could lose everything that we'd already been building. So it became really obvious to me that I either had to go big or I would be risking going home, and that it would be hard to compete with someone who could spend millions and millions of dollars when I was just had my profits, a few hundred thousand dollars of profit here and there going back into the business. So it just be the urgency of, okay, I can't let someone else do that when I'm already doing it just because they're more well-networked than me. I can't have that happen. So it really, it was another one of those moments that lit a fire underneath me that said, if you're going to do this, go do it. Don't pansy around with half-assing this. Go get this done. Go raise money too, so that at least you could compete and have a chance of building, staying in the game. And the reality was, we had a better business because we'd already figured out how to be profitable. So that was very valuable knowledge to us. And the business had forced us to be profitable because we didn't have millions of dollars of outside capital right away. But by that point, then all I needed was more capital to fuel what we already had. Nobody needed to take a bet on a random idea. I could demonstrate how good our business was already on paper and in reality, and put fuel in our tank to help us grow faster and do more quicker.
So what did you do then? How did you actually go out and get the investment? Was that a difficult process? How much did you raise?
It was way harder than I thought it was going to be. I thought if I also pitched up like he had pitched up and I had the business, not just an idea, that people would be falling over themselves to write me a check. They weren't. They didn't. It took me about 18 months of talking to a lot of the wrong people. And I had not realized that people who invest tend to have very niche theses. They tend to invest in specific things with specific metrics for a specific amount of time. And I didn't understand any of that. So figuring out who the right kind of investors might be, realizing I needed to look for people who liked investing in hospitality, people that were not only focused on tech. A lot of the people I reached out to kept saying to me, "You're not a tech company. You're not tech." And I was like, "I'm not tech, but then how do I find someone who isn't?" So I ended up by accident sort of meeting people who had received some investment. So every time I met any another entrepreneur who'd received investment, I said, "Please, would you introduce me to people because I don't know anyone who does this." I wasn't very well networked and I needed other people's warm introductions to help me get in front of the right people. And it took about 18 months before finally getting in front of hospitality investors, people who did like my space, who would write the right kind of check that I needed. And I eventually got a term sheet for about $7 million. I think I went out to raise 3 or 4 million. And they came back and said, "I think you're going to need a bit more than that." And they were right. I needed a lot more than that. And they wrote me a term sheet for $7 million, which said, "You're going to do this. And these are all the terms and conditions for us writing you a $7 million check." So I was so relieved and so thankful that finally I had got someone to say yes. Except as we started to get into the nitty-gritty of it all and started to wrangle on the terms and do legals and they started to do due diligence, there were a few flags that came up for me. And every time a flag came up, I would just dismiss it and say, "Oh, that's maybe the way they're used to doing business. I don't do business like that, but I'll go with it because they've got the money." And I would ignore it. And then there would be another thing that would happen, and they would say something, or the term would be weird or uncomfortable, or, and I would have to go, "Don't like that, but okay, let's put that under the rug too." And I ended up with a rug that was stuffed full of a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't like, that I had kept sweeping under the carpet until the carpet was no longer able to stand on top of. It was like this monstrous mound. And finally, my husband said to me, "You know, we can't do this deal, don't you?" And I was like, "What do you mean? What do you mean we can't do this deal? We have to do this deal. This is the only deal I've been able to get to the table. We can't possibly pull the rug out from under it now. And besides, there's all this junk under the rug. I can't move the rug." And he said, "I just can't. This isn't right." And I was like, "Okay, let me negotiate. Let me, like," so I went back to the table. I started telling them all the things that weren't working and maybe we needed to fix this and fix that. They weren't budging, not one inch. So I still had this mound of stuff that wasn't really working for us. And I had no idea what I was going to do about it. Jake kept telling me, you've got to pull the plug. You've got to pull the plug." And I was like, "I don't want to pull the plug. I don't know how we're going to fund the business if I keep doing that." And then an issue happened in the business. And because they were still in diligence and they were still like scrutinizing the business in every which way you can possibly imagine, I called them up to tell them and give them a heads up that something had gone wrong with us acquiring a piece of land for one of our future sites. And there was a problem that I was going to solve this problem, but this had happened and I was coming clean about it and giving them a heads up. And I was expecting them to say to me, "What support do you need? Can we get our legal team on that? Do you need help? How can we be helpful?" Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I did not get that. And I got another response that I wanted to like shove under the rug, except this time it was so glaringly awful, their response to this particular issue. And his particular response to me made me think, "I can't do business with you. This is never going to be a marriage made in happy. You are a bully. This is not a win scenario for you and me. This is me having to live with a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't work for me. And you getting, it wasn't a great scenario." So after that conversation, I called him back a couple of days later and said, "We can't do this deal. Thank you very much for all the time and energy you've spent on it, but we can't do it." And he went crazy at me and completely all the red flags that I had stored up over here under my rug were like flying everywhere. And there were so many red, the flags in the sky that it was just like red. If I wasn't sure that I should pull the plug, I'm really sure now. So it was a devastating moment because we really needed the capital to invest and grow the business. And I knew I had a competitor coming up alongside me. We were perilously short of cash. And so it was very distressing, but it taught me an amazing lesson. When you've got a red flag that someone's flying up in front of you, never ignore it. If someone's showing you who they are, believe them. If they're showing you before you're in business with them that they are not someone you want to do business with, definitely do not. And it was like a growing up moment of who do I want to be in business? How do I want to do business? And what kind of partners do I need to do business with? And I realized this firm were not going to be it for me. Maybe for someone else, but definitely not for me.
So, did you ultimately find another investor? And how did that happen? How long did that take?
I had to take a very painful step back. There was more crying. There was more feeling sorry for myself until I picked myself back up and said, okay, I have to get this business funded. We have to move forward some way. It's probably about another year after that moment. It took me a while to get back in the race and to get back on the horse and go out there and try and find the right kind of investors. And in the end, I ended up using a broker who became like the matchmaker, if you like, with trying to find people that would be a good fit for me and my business and would get me and get my agenda and understand my vision and values and try and align. And that was one of the best things I ever did, get some help to navigate these waters, because these waters are super murky. They're super difficult to wrangle. And having a person in the middle, whilst that's going to cost some money, actually, the next year we went out and raised in $15 million. I gave away a tiny piece of equity. We put a whole bunch of debt in the business, which I could afford because we were cash producing. So we levered the business, took on some equity, and double the money that I would have done if we'd had the year before. And we were really ready to execute on all of that capital and put it to work right away, very efficiently. So it was very tough at the time, but ultimately, it was definitely the best decision I ever made.
And a big part of your book is about the pitch deck. It's about putting together the deck that you're going to show to investors. So tell me about the deck itself. How important is it versus how important are you, the founder? And how much is the investor investing in you versus investing in what the pitch deck says?
Investors are always investing in people. 100% investors are looking for extraordinary people to make things happen. That's how investors make money, right? That you make extraordinary things happen and build an extraordinary business. So, an average idea in the hands of someone extraordinary who's going to really take that idea and milk it for all it's worth is definitely preferable for an investor than someone who's got the best idea. No one's ever seen this thing. This is like going to the moon. But you can't execute on it and you don't have the capabilities to make it happen. Investment is all about you. And the pitch deck is really just a tool for telling your story and making sure you tell the story in a way that makes you and your business compelling. And what I realized, having sold Under Canvas several years ago now and becoming an investor myself, was that so many of us are not very good at telling our story, not very good at putting together the data and the information and the story that really matters. And I didn't understand when I was out raising investment, as I said, the things that really mattered to investors. And now sitting on the other side of the table, I know, and having built my own business, I know some of the disconnects that happen as folks do that in the pitch deck. So I really wrote this book to help other people learn from the things that I didn't know, the mistakes that I made on my journey, and help people craft a story that not only sells your business, but really sells you as someone who has enormous potential to do something extraordinary.
Tell me a story about one of the folks, perhaps, that you've invested in, and what was it about their story that was so compelling? How did they tell their story, and why was it effective for investors?
For me, I am always looking for two things when I'm looking for entrepreneurs. I'm looking at how much do you care? Like, how much does this concept, this idea really matter to you? How much skin have you got into the game? Are you all in on executing on your vision? And I have met a lot of folks who often want investors to de-risk them, especially early stage folks. You say, it's going to cost me a lot to try this idea. And maybe we want investment to subsidize the risk and take, you want the investor to take the risk for you. And investment doesn't really work like that. Investment is about pouring fuel on something that investors think is a really good bet. And the surer the idea, the surer the sense of that we think this is going to work, the more likely it is for money to be poured into it. So I am always looking for, and I have some wonderful, incredible female entrepreneurs who are so passionate about solving really big problems. And that's the second thing that I look for, is how big is the problem that you are trying to solve? Are you clear about the problem that your business is trying to solve? Do you really care about solving that so that you're all in? Maybe you sold your house, your car, you gave your job up, whatever it was, you're fully invested in making this thing happen. And then how big of an opportunity, how big of a problem this really is. If this is a problem that affects you and your five friends, I'm not so interested. If this is a problem that can affect millions and millions of people and we could solve it with a piece of technology or a product or a service, I'm in. And those are probably the two core things for me. I have one company in Zambia that is solving, trying to create a banking service for people who live on less than $1 or $2 a day, serving very low income folks, but creating financial services for them in a way that is easy to access, creates liquidity for them so that they can get into their businesses, can make things happen, can buy and sell, can make lives work, and effectively, therefore, increase wealth from the bottom up. And her demographic and the problem that she's trying to solve, there are very few companies trying to serve her demographic. And of course, there's a billion, probably almost a billion people in Africa that effectively her company could serve. So she has a huge problem and a huge idea and a product and services that can really make a difference in our lives. So that's really the heart of what I look for. How much change can we drive? How much do you care? How big is the problem that you've got?
So you ended up getting the $15 million investment. What happened to the other guy who was out there pitching your idea? Where is he today?
He has a glamping business. He has four or five locations. To my knowledge, that business is not profitable, but I don't know exactly what his numbers are. I don't think he figured out a scalable, repeatable model to quickly be able to execute on opening more locations. He's probably where I was when I got funded. I finally got funded. That's where that business is today.
He was a catalyst for you to really get that
Was.
outside investment.
Yeah, he actually did me a favor. He did me a huge favor. And the other advantage of a competitor coming into my space was they helped me grow an industry. They poured more money into marketing and exposing the whole concept because we were a new concept. Glamping didn't exist 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And now it's everybody knows what glamping is. It's definitely a thing. It's a $5 billion industry in the US now. And at that time, it was a no in, it was nothing industry. And having competitors come into the space helped market an industry, helped market a concept, not just one brand. And that actually really helped propel us.
The last thing I want to ask you about is I think you ended up selling the business and now you've got your own fund. You're an investor, you're investing in other companies. Tell me about that and why you decided to go from being the founder operator to now being an investor and seeding other businesses.
Yeah. One of the reasons I became an investor was there were so few women I ever met who were investing. And I generally disliked the investment world. It generally wasn't a place, and the people I was generally meeting, it felt very sharky. It felt very win-lose scenario. And there was a lot about it that I just thought, I don't think this has to be like this. I don't think it has to be done this way. And so few women get funded. There's just 2% of all venture capital dollars go to women each year. And I felt angry about that. And I felt like this shouldn't be like this. And if only a certain demographic of people are getting investment, only certain types of companies are getting built. And that influences the world that we all live in, because I believe businesses build the world. And so if women are not getting funded, people of color are not getting funded, we are perpetuating an unequal world, and we're perpetuating a world that isn't necessarily good for everyone. So I just wanted to play a small part in the idea of revolutionizing what investment capital could look like and who was getting those dollars. So today I only invest in female entrepreneurs. I'm only backing women with great ideas solving big problems. And I'm typically focused on investing in Africa because trying to drive a development angle also. But yeah, so that became my thesis. But sitting on the other side of the table has been enlightening on many fronts.
I can imagine. And knowing you the way I do, you're not going to play a small part. You're going to play a big part in helping other women entrepreneurs be successful and make a huge impact. So, Sarah, it's always great to connect with you. You've got this great new book called Thinking Bigger, a pitch deck formula for women who want to change the world. And you are certainly one of those women who is changing the world. So, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks very much for having me. I am certainly trying to do my part.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Now, I have a question for you. How are you going to implement and benefit from the ideas that you hear on our show? Well, we would love to have a conversation with you about that. So please visit us at ceocoachinginternational.com. We can then set up a call and we can talk about how we can help you make big happen in your business. Thanks, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you.